Art of the Cut is brought to you by FilmTools.com, your one-stop shop for production and post-production gear. Be sure to listen for an exclusive site-wide offer later in the show. Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film editor and discuss the art and craft of film editing with my colleagues in film and TV. Today on Art of the Cut, I'm so happy to be talking to William Goldenberg, ACE, about Paul Greengrass's News of the World. Billy and I have talked before about Paul Greengrass's 22 July, Catherine Bigelow's Detroit, and Ben Affleck's Live by Night. Billy's list of awards is longer than most people's entire filmographies. He was nominated for his first Ace Eddie in 2000 for The Insider, which also garnered him an Oscar nomination. He's had Ace Eddie and Oscar nominations for Seabiscuit. In 2013, he was nominated for Ace Eddies and BAFTAs for both Argo and Zero Dark Thirty, and he won an Oscar for Argo. And he was nominated for an Ace Eddie, BAFTA, and an Oscar for The Imitation Game. Other films edited by Billy include Transformers Dark of the Moon, National Treasure, Gone Baby Gone, Ali, The Long Kiss Goodnight, and Heat. Billy, man, it is so good to talk to you again. I enjoy our discussions so much. The last time I talked to you was on another Paul Greengrass film, and you said it was a little scary to start a new relationship. It was a new director for you. I'm assuming that you guys have a nice working relationship now two movies in.
Yeah, we do. Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me on. Paul's just, I mean, I knew immediately on the last movie that he was a terrific person, and I had a feeling it was going to be a good working relationship, but it's turned into probably one of the best, if not the best, working relationships I've had with a director. I mean, he's so collaborative that it really does feel like a partnership. So it's been wonderful. And he's a wonderful person. And I think we're, at this point, friends. Our families are friends. So it's been lovely.
Oh, that's great. What's the benefit of having a director use an editor multiple times?
I mean, the benefits are immeasurable. You know, there's no breaking in period. You know, it's like getting a pair of boots that are already broken in.
That makes you the shoes.
Yes. I guess I'll be the shoes. That's okay. What's so great about it is that you're totally comfortable with each other on the day one and not on day 50. You know, oftentimes when a new relationship with a director, what happens is you meet them a little bit, you know, you get hired, you go on the film, I've made several discussions, but then they're shooting. And you get then from then on during the shoot, you get sort of a distracted director. You know, they have so many things on their plate. And then when they are looking at cut footage, mostly they're looking at their own work. What do I need? What did I miss? You know, they're not really examining the editing in the way they will when we're in post-production. Paul and I, or the other, I've had several directors that I have, you know, multiple films with. You just go in, like, it's like hitting the ground running, you know, as opposed to sort of getting up to speed. And also we have Paul and I now have developed a shorthand about stuff, and I came to the set a lot on this film, which I don't usually do. And Paul had me come to make sure that we were both agreed that this is the right direction for the tone of the film, the tone of Tom Hanks's performance. So, you know, so that made this show even more fun than the last. And it's also a little more upbeat subject matter than the last one.
Absolutely. You mentioned shorthand. Can you explain, like, something that would be a shorthand that you developed or just made things faster?
Well, what makes things the best thing is that, and he said this to me on the first film, 22 July, when it was time for me to show him the cut, he said, look, show me the cut you want to show me. You don't have to leave everything in. You know, take it out what you want to take out, trim it how you want to trim it, move things around how you want to move things around, and I'll see the movie. I know my own material. If there's something I miss or I don't like, I'll tell you. And if I want to see something you took out, I'll tell you, and we'll put it back in, or we'll look at it and decide whether we want to put it back in. And that direction didn't come to me until very near the end of the shoot. So going into this one, I knew right from the get-go that I could basically do whatever I felt was right for the film. And so when I showed him scenes early on where I had taken things out, trimmed it down, and he shoots with the idea of bringing things down. I mean, I've never had this direct conversation with him, but my feeling is what he does is overwrite the scenes, add extra dialogue, knowing he's going to take it out. Because when they're short scenes, I think what he's doing is in an effort to get the actors to really immerse themselves, get into their parts, being able to improv. He gives them extra stuff to do, knowing he's going to pull it back. so that they don't, you know, like a scene might be only a page long, but it'll give them an extra half a page of dialogue and it gets them revved up. You know, they get into their, they get into the moments deep, more deeply. And then, and so I instinctually know now that I can cut those things back. When we get to post, I think we're much further along. It's not really an assembly anymore, editor's cut or whatever you want to call it. I think when we get to that point, it's more of, you know, we're in progress to the director's cut at that point. We're already, we saved a lot of time, maybe a couple of weeks. You know, we've talked all the way through, and he had the guy, the lead singer of Mumford and Son is a friend of his, and he brought him to the cutting room. I think they must have had a tour date in Santa Fe. It was pre-COVID when there were concerts. And he brought him into the cutting room and he says, and I had a bunch of new material and he just said, oh, just run it. We'll just run it. And I was just like, oh my God. And I, you know, I'm so nervous about things when they run for the first time. But luckily everybody liked it. But it was, you know, that's the kind of trust we have in each other and he has in me. So I think that's the most valuable shorthand is the this unspoken, do whatever you want, you know.
One of the things you mentioned a second ago was about tone, that he brought you on the set and sometimes, hey, you know, do we have the tone right? That's a big thing for a director. It's one of their main responsibilities is setting the tone. How are you helping set the tone other than going on set?
Well, I'm obviously setting the tone by the kind of temp music I put in, the sound design. Once you shoot something, that's some of the, obviously it's a lot of the tone is ingrained, you know, but you can obviously slide things one way or the other. By music, by pace, by sound effects, sound design. It depends on the variety of performance you're getting from actors. Al Pacino is somebody I cut in a couple of films, and he gives you, you know, from A to Z a lot of times, like screaming, whispering, and everything in between. So you can really mess with the tone there. But getting that consistent tone is one of the most important and difficult things, I think, of cutting a film. So if that doesn't work, then it feels disjointed and it feels like, well, you know, it just feels like nothing is living in the same world.
We talked several times for Detroit and 22 July, and I know you cut Imitation Game and Zero Dark 30. There are a lot of movies that seem to have like a political or social commentary and help add to the societal discussion. Is this film like that?
Well, it turns out that it is. I mean, it takes place in 1870, about 5 years after the Civil War, when the country was very divided still, you know, even though it was 5 years later, Texas was deciding, you know, if they were going to get back into the Union or not. There was still a lot of hatred between the North and the South. The Southerners looked at the Northern army like their occupying army type thing. And I think that that's very relevant to what's happening today, too. So we didn't know that it was going to be so relevant. But as things got more divided in this country, as is certainly this year has gone on, and then obviously with the pandemic, it's really become a lot more relevant.
You mentioned COVID, and also you mentioned going on set. Tell me a little bit about when you shot and when you moved back to LA, that kind of stuff.
We shot from September to Thanksgiving, and I was on location, you know, just in an office in Santa Fe. But we were always, the furthest I think they ever shot was 45 minutes from Santa Fe. So I was able, even when we were that far away, which is not that far, I was able to drive out, spend half a day there, come back and still be able to cut. You know, made for long days, but that was okay. You know, for me to be that involved in the shooting, I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way. It's like, it's such a rare opportunity to have that kind of input. And I even worked with Paul in the screenplay on this film. Like last summer, I went to London for a couple of weeks and we sat down and hashed out all the way through the screenplay as he was writing it. So that was nice to have input there, you know. Anyway, so after Thanksgiving, we spent the holidays here in LA. And then afterwards, I went to London in the beginning of January. And I was in London, as Paul lives there, all the way through March 14th or 15th when, you know, the whole world shut down. I was actually coming back to the States anyway to show the studio the film. And I kept the same plane reservation. I just never went back. But after we got back in the middle of March, I think it was about 3 weeks later, our producer, Greg Goodman, just took the reins and said, we're going to go back up. Everybody got it, you know, we made many copies of the film and everybody worked from their houses. I had two assistants here in LA, three assistants in London, a visual effects editor, a music editor, all in different locations. And we made it work, you know. Things took a little bit longer, but technology is to the point where it made it pretty smooth. I mean, there were times you had to wait a couple of minutes, but I mean, considering we got to keep working and we got to finish the film, and we used Evercast, the director and I used Evercast to be able to communicate to each other, and he's able to see my work, and it was pretty seamless, I have to say. And we wrapped up we were supposed to finish in June. We ended up finishing in July. And then we waited 2 months to preview because they were waiting for the situation to sort of level out COVID-wise. We previewed a couple of times, made some additional changes, and then we just last week finished the mix again. Yeah, so it was on the film over a year, but it was supposed to be from September to June, and it made it September to, with a little hiatus in there, September to last week.
I haven't had a chance to see this film, so I'm going to have you guide me a little bit in our discussion. Can you think of something that would be educational, a lesson that you learned, or a lesson that someone else could learn as an editor from something that happened on this film, whether it was something you had to change, something that occurred to you, like, oh, I could do this. Here's this problem I have.
The thing that was difficult about this film, I don't know if this is really answering the question, but the thing that was difficult about this film is all the distance. I mean, having the distance between working, and I'm talking about time now, like having 3 weeks doing nothing and then going back, and then finishing and then having 2 months and then going back. And then we previewed and had 3 weeks. I mean, everything took so much time. I did learn that, I guess it's patience, you know, that you're so angry, and I've always sort of been a fairly patient editor, but it's just amazing how if you use that time well, you know, I was able to see the film in a completely fresh way. And I think the film ultimately was for the better because I was able to see it fresh on so many different at so many different times. I mean, usually I assume it's the same for other editors. You know, you see a film so many times that some screenings are very valuable, and that you feel like you've seen it for the first time or seeing it fresh. And sometimes it feels like, oh my God, here we go again, this scene, now this scene. And it just kind of washes over you a little bit. And you're seeing it, but you're not really seeing it like an audience sees it. So, and I relearned, I guess, that the process is important and the patience is important. That you won't know in week one what you're going to know in week 10. And not try and be very like drastic with your changes and like let it evolve. You know, I think that was on so many levels that made me an even more patient editor, which I sometimes can get very like, okay, how do I fix this now? How do I do this now? How do I get it? How do I get it perfect right now? And the understanding that that's going to sometimes take some time. I mean, the only editor I know who can do it seemingly perfect every time is Michael Kahn, where he just seems to like, oh yeah, I'll cut it this way. Oh, that looks great. Perfect. You know, but, I think most mortals take a little more time. So I did learn, you know, unfortunately, I'm not going to be afforded with all that time on a lot of films, but I think it's going to be valuable going forward just to have that sort of trust that it's going to work out, you know.
The objectivity that affords you to have stepped away for that long and see a cut, you know, a lot of people, and I don't know whether you're one of them, but like you sometimes when you don't have the time, you cut a scene and set it aside so that in a week you can come back and look at it again. Oh, wow. I either totally failed or
yeah.
I did a pretty good job, right? It's interesting that a couple of films that I've heard of, especially films where like a lead actor gets injured, those films really benefit from the time off.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the sort of blessings, curses of the movie business, you know, you don't really finish. They just sort of take it away, you know. But at the same time, there's a wonderful thing about that. The relationships, you meet so many people and, you know, everything is always fresh. You know, you're on a film 9 months to a year, maybe sometimes a little more, a little less. But then you get reinvigorated every time the movie comes, you know, another movie comes. And it's a whole new set of people, a whole new set of challenges, a new story to tell. So that's wonderful. But it is... I mean, there are films where I wish I had done that. I mean, I don't think it's ever affected the box office or the quality of the film, but in my mind, like, I wish I could go back and take those four shots out or switch the order of that or something, you know? So I think the movie is sharper and better for having had the time. So I guess that's one sort of small, tiny benefit of having this horrible pandemic.
As I said, I haven't seen the movie, but in the trailer, there's a guy that says, they pay you to tell stories? I didn't know something that was something a man could do. Did you feel a kinship with Tom Hanks' character?
I could see. I never thought about that, actually. And now that you say it, I think that there is a kinship in that, you know, that you're guiding the audience to see a story a certain way. And that's what he was doing. You know, what he did was he would go from town to town, and a lot of these towns didn't get all the papers from different parts of the country and different parts of the world. So people did go and charge a small amount, and he'd you know, set up like in a barn or a church and read the news. And he was a master storyteller.
Love it. Is it a fairly linear story? Is there any intercutting or jumps in time?
There's jumps in time because it's a 4-month journey that we're obviously compressing into 2 hours. But it is a pretty linear story. And the challenge of it was there's no B story. So you're with them the whole time. So there's no like, oh, let's cut to the other story and we'll overlap and cross cut. And there, you can't do that in this film. So it's a question of keeping the pace going, but still making it feel like it's a journey. You know, you don't want to upcut it so much that it feels like, wait, that isn't 4 months. That looks like 4 minutes, you know. If it's all slow or it's all really fast, it's going to feel boring. You can make the whole thing super fast. Make it, take a 2-hour movie and make it an hour and a half. It's going to feel longer because you need dynamic range. You need highs and lows. And you know, for me, it's I don't know how other editors do it. For me, where things should slow down and speed up, sometimes it's just obvious in the script, but other times it's just by feel, you know, you're just feeling like, okay, we've just had this big, very big set piece in the center. And so after that, we don't want to like fly into the next bit. You want to like let the audience settle. And because the characters are sort of regrouping and the characters are sort of settling like in their minds, well, what just happened? You know, like, how do I even deal with this in my head? So you want to let the audience experience what the characters are experiencing. So you want to like put them in that same mindset. Paul Greengrass would refer to it as living in the scene or skating over the scene. Even in the fast-paced stuff, you want the audience to live in there, but then they're accepting of that because it's nervous and it's tense, and so that you accept that sort of quicker pace. But then when it's time to slow down, you know, you have to slow down with the characters so the audience will slow down and be able to absorb things. So a lot of that, to me, is feel. You know, you just sense it when you're watching it. They're just zipping through this. It's like people aren't going to get this. People aren't going to feel it, you know, because it's one thing to intellectually understand something, whatever the characters are going through, but it's another thing to let them feel it, you know, for them to feel what the characters, you know, to get inside them and really like understand, so they feel like they're experiencing it along with Tom, because there's always something relatable in every character. So even if it's a bad guy, you want to make everybody three-dimensional and you want to make everybody feel like, you know, you understand where they're coming from. It's not just some like the bad guy's not just some guy with a black hat, you know, it's like with a gun that you see how he got there, you know, and that makes stories really, really sing, you know, that makes stories really deep and people walk away from your film and they'll remember it, you know, as opposed to, hey, that was fun. Next, what are we having for dinner? As opposed to thinking that the next day, well, you know, that really landed with me. And I think that's the difference. You know, you want to really let the audience soak in that world. So you just have to figure out what those moments are.
How much of that is contextual and how much of it, as you said, oh, you know it because you read the script and here's the fast scene and here's the slow scene. So when you're cutting, I'm assuming out of order, maybe you cut a scene too fast when it's out of order. And then when it gets in context, you go, oh, I got to open this up.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, like one example is there's one of the readings in the film where things go a little sideways because of the, you know, again, the butting of heads between the North and the South. And Tom is able, or Captain Kidd, he's Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd, he's able to sort of calm things down so they don't, you know, blow up into a fight or even something worse. And my son came to, I have a 20-year-old son, he came to Santa Fe, and I showed him the scene, and I hadn't looked at it in context. I had looked at it, but I hadn't really looked at it. You know, I had strung the stuff together, but so I showed him the scene and he looked at the, and he thought it was good and looked at the end and goes, I think it's good. I think what's happening at the end is happening a little fast for me. It doesn't feel real. And then I looked at it through his eyes and I was like, he's absolutely right. And I slowed things down at the end and it wasn't like he didn't believe it before, but then it became real. Now that, you know, the scene has time to breathe at the end where you feel like, okay, this could happen in this time frame. And that's why I love having somebody else in the room. I see it through their eyes. But yeah, you cut it with your best guess, you know, about where it sits in the movie. And, you know, I'll always read like three scenes before the scene I'm about to cut and three scenes after to get my, you know, my mind fixed as to where we are in the story. But, you know, nobody's perfect. So you do your best and then you go, yeah, I'm jumping into this scene so fast. Or you might find I'm like, I don't need the first half of this next scene because it's all clear. So let's jump into the middle of the next scene. But, you know, that's part of the process that we were talking about before. So as you go on through the 10 weeks of the director's cut and then however long the producers have and the preview process, you start learning, you know, you really get to know the film even more intimately than you did before. So, you know, yes, of course, you know, in context, everything changes.
I love it. Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree then.
He's got a good education, I have to say. I mean, he really gets the story in a way that I find very impressive. And he sees things all the time that I'm like, wow, that's great. And you know, it's great to have your son. When you're impressed by something your son says, as a father, you feel like, wow, I did something right.
I've watched TV with my son before and caught him at a young age, like 8 or 9 or 12 or something. He was like, that can't be the right guy. It's only 40 minutes in. That can't be the...
Yeah, right.
This has got to be the red hair.
That guy's not going to die. Right, yeah.
We'll be back in a moment with more of my interview with Billy Goldenberg. Today's episode of the Art of the Cut podcast is brought to you by FilmTools.com. Since 1996, FilmTools has been Hollywood's one-stop shop for all things production and post. No matter your filmmaking needs, FilmTools has you covered when you need gear for your next shoot or edit. This week, FilmTools is offering Art of the Cut listeners 10% off thousands of products when shopping on FilmTools.com. All you have to do is enter code AOTC10 at checkout. That's AOTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your purchase on FilmTools.com. So whether you need a G-Tech hard drive or an Arri Sky panel, make sure to head over to FilmTools.com and check out with discount code AOTC10. To get 10% off your next equipment purchase. And now back to my interview with Billy Goldenberg. We talked about regulating tone. How important is perspective, either in this film or in any film? Do you decide what the perspective is, or do you have a discussion with Paul about perspective?
Yeah, we had a lot of discussion about that, because it's a very sort of lonesome, but there are very few characters in the film, and it's Tom and the little girl's name is in the film. The actress's name is Helena Zengel, but her character's name in the film is Joanna. It's going to be one of their points of view, or both of their points of view. And we had a lot of discussions in the screenplay phase about what the point of view of the story is going to be. Is it going to be the two of them? Are we going to meet them individually? And we went back and forth about how to start the film, because we decided that it was important that it would be told mostly from Tom's perspective, or from his point of view. So we had to keep adjusting the front of the film to stay with that vision, and we got away from it at one point in the cutting, and then we came back to it at the end. It would be from Tom's point of view. I mean, you really were able to feel what Joanna was feeling and see things through her eyes as well, but it really mostly came down to, this is Tom's story, Tom's character's story. You know, that both characters need healing, but his is the one we're going to concentrate on. It really was a constant discussion, like from last summer, not this past summer, the summer before that, from basically the beginning of the screenwriting phase in June all the way through the shooting. Because Paul is constantly rewriting during the shooting. He's constantly honing and honing and honing, you know, every day. And that's why it's important that I'm on location with him, because not only is he seeing cuts every day, but he's also feeding me pages almost every day. We have a whole sort of system. I get pages at night, and in the morning I talk to his development person, Emily, and we then discuss our notes on these pages, and then we whittle them down to the really core stuff, and then we give them to Paul, and he takes some of them and doesn't take others, you know. Or I'll say, yeah, we could lose that, or we could do this way, but I want to do it this way because, you know. And sometimes that's what I was speaking about before. I said we could drop these lines, and he'll say, well, yeah, we could, but I'd rather shoot him and have you drop him. So it's just a wonderful way for me to get inside his head and get inside the story of inside the film's head. You know what I mean? Like you get immersed to the point where you feel like you're in the world with them. So all that stuff lends to that for me. So it's great.
I'm really impressed that he asked you to come out to help with the script. Obviously, editors, we consider ourselves storytellers. What do you think it was that he said, this guy knows story and he can help me? How did that relationship happen that he would ask you?
On 20th of July, I met him after the screenplay was written. You know, it was a very fast thing. He wrote the screenplay. I think he finished it in August, and they were shooting in October. So he called me. I was in New York on a film. He called me in September, and it was like, we got to go. You know, like, do you want to come to Norway, like, in 3 weeks? So we didn't have any time in the beginning to sort of even know each other. I met him in person the night before the first day of shooting in Norway at the hotel we were all staying at. it was a little slow in terms of getting that relationship started because he was shooting and they were on like these different locations in the time. And it was like no daylight because it's Norway in the winter. And it was just a really crazy shooting schedule. But then as we went on, he started sending me those pages every night. Take a look at these, see what you think. Tell me what your thoughts are, but tell me soon because I'm shooting him tomorrow. So I guess my sense is that he must have thought what I was doing made sense. And actually, even before that, he had two versions of that script. One where the attacks were told in flashback, is 22 July, and one where it was in real time. And I felt strongly that the film should be the way it is now, in real time. And we talked about that a lot before we ever met. And it was like very early in our relationship. And I think we both landed in the same place. And I think he respected the reasons that I had for doing it that way. And then it was, again, when we got to shooting and he was giving me pages and I was giving him notes, which I assume he liked. And then when I showed him the film, because I think I took 40 minutes out of the film before I showed it to him the first time. So I think it made 35 or 40, I can't quite remember. And I restructured things as I was watching it with my assistant. I was like, oh, this feels like it should be here, and this feels like it should be here. And I moved things around, and he seemed to like everything I did. I mean, he didn't undo any of it. So I think that must have been, I'm just guessing, now you'd have to ask him, but I'm guessing that he saw that I sort of knew instinctually how a story should be told, or that story should be told. So then then in all our discussions and about other movies and theater and books or whatever, he had a sense that I maybe knew what I was talking about, or I fooled him into thinking. I've probably fooled him into thinking I knew what I was talking about.
That you were simpatico.
Yeah, so we saw things, we were seeing the same movie. And in this particular, in News of the World, there was an original screenplay which Paul rewrote, and then there was the book. So Paul's similar to me in that he doesn't always listen to what the suggestions, but he hears it and he takes it in.
He listens, but he doesn't take them.
No, he would listen, and then he would take the ones he wanted. But I think for him, having another person involved in that process, like I'm saying, like I like to have somebody in the room because I see it. I think that, again, I'm speaking for him, and I may be totally wrong, but I get the feeling he likes that as being part of the process, that it pushes him. Usually he'll do something that does what I was talking about, but it's better.
Well, that's something that I've talked about with many people, is that a lot of times a bad idea, not saying your ideas are bad, a bad idea can lead to a good solution, right?
Yeah. So that's why there's no bad ideas, you know. And a director may have, you know, happens to all editors, a director may say, oh, I think we should do this and do it by doing XYZ. And you do XYZ and it's not what, you know, that it's not what he was intending in terms of the outcome. So, of course, you want to show him that. But then you also want to say, well, I think what you were going for is this. And so I did what you said, but I think what you're trying to get to might be this. So I did another version or another two versions that might be more in that direction. So I think those are the kind of things that enables trust in the relationship, you know, that you're doing exactly what he said, so you're not ignoring him, but you're also trying to bring something to the table and say, like, I see it another way. I see maybe we can get there by a more clever way, or just a different way that's a little more outside the box, or whatever it is, you know. And I think that's a similar process that Paul goes to with his writing, because he also includes Greg Goodman, I was mentioning before, a producer. He'll include him, and he has a terrific relationship with my first assistant, Peter Dudgeon, who has a master's in screenwriting. He was a theater actor, and he just knows story as well. So he'll ask Peter to read the script and give him feedback as well. You know, so he likes to have a lot of voices, but then he's very good at just sort of then tuning all of it out and then doing everything better than we all had ever suggested. So then that's the, you know, he's, I mean, he really is an auteur in terms of that. I mean, he knows what he wants. He knows how to get there. He is incredibly thoughtful. It's all his film, you know. I mean, he accepts all the help he can get from the people he trusts.
This is not a usual thing of a director saying, cut it the way you want to cut it. I'm assuming you have worked with other directors as well, where the editor's cut is not really an editor's cut. It's an assembly made exactly the way the script is written.
Yeah. I mean, I would never... In fact, when Paul first told me to do it on 20 July, I thought it was a trick. I thought it was a trick, you know. I thought, is this real? Like, am I going to get, I don't know, you know. I literally, because it's never happened before. I mean, I saw Michael Caine and Steven Spielberg had a similar relationship. You know, I think that Paul even lets me go further. I mean, Michael and Steven have worked together for like, I don't know, 40 years. I think it's 40 years at this point. But yes, in most films, I would never do that. I would cut the script, make everything work as best as I could. I mean, and it would be long, but it would be a movie. But, you would see places, half that scene's coming out or those lines are going to be. And I might ask to do that. I would say, like, do you think we need these lines on the phone? And they would say, yeah, well, maybe not, but leave them in just so I can see them. So, no, I mean, it's the first time I've ever, it's the only time that I've ever had that kind of relationship with a director. You know, like I said, he's seen every scene cut. It's not like he never looks at it or he never looked at it. You know, he knows what he shot and I'll show him the scene separately and I'll say, yeah, you're right to take that out. Or like there are a couple, one or two scenes in this film that I did take out that we did put back in. I think it may have been one now, but might have been two. I can't remember. But he's brilliant and he knows what he has. He knows the story he's trying to tell. So I think it just helps him move the ball down the field, you know.
Did you read the book, I'm assuming, before you edited the film?
Yeah, I did. I did. And I generally tend not to when there's a book, but he asked me to read the book. So because he hadn't written a script yet, because the other books I've worked on, Unbroken, Seabiscuit, Imitation Game was based on it wasn't called The Imitation Game, the book. The reason I'm telling the story is because on Seabiscuit, I did read the book. I read the screenplay, which I loved, and then I went back and read the book. And then when I started talking to Gary about the film, and I think it was even when we were shooting, Gary Ross, the writer-director, a few times I said, well, in the book, blah, 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 blah. And then in the book, I think the third time he stopped me and said, this isn't the book. We're making this script about this particular story part of the book. So yeah. I don't want to hear about the book. So it got me in a little bit of trouble. I mean, he didn't like yell at me or anything, but it got me in a little bit of trouble. And I thought, something? It's better to concentrate on this script and the story I'm making, because Seabiscuit, what Gary did was so, so brilliant. He took the book and the themes and he made it a story about family and a father and Red Pollard, like a father and son relationship, and which is in the book, but not really. And he made a specific story, confined to this little slice of what was happening in that grand book. And it made it a more micro instead of macro. And I think that's what made it a great story, where I've seen other, adaptations of books where it's like, it's just like rehashing what's in the book. And then this happens and this happens. It's not getting really inside the story and making it like a relatable story. It's a great book, but I think the book just as the book wouldn't have been a great movie. And where Gary was able to grab onto threads that were universal and made for great stories of that length.
I worked on a movie that was based on a book and I didn't read the book. And where it helped was I saw a bunch of places where I'm like, it's in the book. It's not in the movie. This doesn't make any sense. You're like, you remember this from the book. I do not. And so therefore I don't understand this whole story point.
Right, right. Yeah.
What do you do for inspiration? What's your muse? What do you do when you're not cutting?
Oh, I do so much cutting. Yeah. I think the thing that helps me is I listen to a ton of music, especially with these lovely EarPod Pros, where you feel like you put them in, noise reduction mode. And I just find that like recharges me and I think it helps with rhythm, in a way, like you feel like you're doing something, you're listening to something rhythmic and that tells its own story. And so I do listen to a lot of music and that recharges me. And strangely watching other films too, a lot of people say, how do you watch movies after you've worked on a movie all day? And I said, well, it's not the same thing. I'm not working on that one. I'm just enjoying it. I think that seeing great films or even great now, there's so much great television. I think it gets me like charged up. Like I want to do that too, and I go in the next day with a real head of steam, I think it's seeing other people's work, whether it be music or art or other movies, television shows, reading books, it just gets me like, I get so excited about stories that I feel like I don't want to let this one down. Do you know if that makes any sense? I want this story to be everything it can be because I just saw something or heard a piece of music that is so perfect that it feels like a challenge almost. And then there's also the fear too. The fear is definitely keeps me on my toes of the fear. I don't think it'll ever go away. I think if it goes away, I'll stop being an editor. I've been cutting on my own for, 25 something years and I still feel the same like anxiety of like wanting to get it right and going in every morning and not want to disappoint the director or disappoint myself or disappoint the studio. So I think there is a, if it's channeled correctly, that fear is really keeps an edge, you know.
And you're certainly not the only one. I think it's wonderful that you can admit to that, because there's so many less experienced editors than you that probably feel the same way. Like, you go in the morning, like, I don't know if I can cut another scene. I don't know if I can do this. Mm-hmm. But even, like, I talked to Carol Littleton. I mean, a fantastic editor. She said the exact same thing. She doesn't know when she goes into the office whether she can cut the scene or not.
I mean, almost every scene I cut, especially big sequences, I look at all those, especially when you get like 7 hours of dailies for a 4-minute dialogue scene, and you're like, oh my God, I don't know. I have no idea how to cut this. Like, none. I just don't know where I'm going to start. But then you watch the dailies and watch the dailies and watch the dailies, and you find things to grab onto, and I know I can start on this shot, or this shot's going to be a great end shot, or this is the middle, or this performance is definitely the one, you know, for this four lines or whatever it is. And then you start, and Michael Kahn, who's my mentor, used to refer to it as losing your forebrain, you know, where you just go in the morning at 7 a.m. and then you stop cutting and it's 8, 9 o'clock at night. You're like, what happened? And there's a scene. I feel like that's doing it instinctually is the only way I know how to do it. You know, I had a director who had some computer program about, like, okay, well, at minute 60, this is supposed to happen. Or something, and then minute 75, then this is, and I'm like, I don't think we can really make a movie that way. I mean, I'm sure it'd be a movie. It might not be a good movie. I just think that, you know, it's like people refer, it's like, do you have a button that'll cut this together? You know, like, as, you know, at a certain point, I'm sure there'll be computers that just cut stuff, like, without having to.
Let's hope not.
Yeah, well, but I think you can never get, there's no way to get human emotion, and like that, what coming from an editor or the director or screenwriter, you're just never going to get it that way to be. It's going to be robotic because it'll be done by somebody who doesn't have any emotion, or something that doesn't have an emotion or a feel, you know, or a feeling. That, you know, I don't think that the skill of editing will ever be unnecessary.
How much of that feeling is empathy, or is that what you mean by feeling? Are they two different things?
Yeah, I mean, feel, like a feel for the craft, you know, like you're good at it. You have a natural inclination to it. But making an audience feel something is, I think, a skill that could never be done by some machine. You know, I mean, I think that, and I think you have to feel, you have to be a sensitive person who is in touch with their emotions to be able to do that. I mean, I look at when I'm cutting an emotional scene. I mean, I watch dailies and I think something hits me really hard emotionally, one take as opposed to another. I don't know why sometimes, but it does. And I use that because it makes me feel a certain way. So I'm hoping that I feel like at this point in my career, I do know that a lot of times what I feel is what the audience is going to feel because of the experience that I had at the beginning. You don't know, but I'm not always, but oftentimes I'm right about, like, this is going to be the most emotional take. Well, this made me take, you know, I watched this take and it made me cry. So I'm going to use that one, you know? And then you hope that the audience feels what you feel. I don't know how else to do it, you know.
You mentioned kind of that 7 hours of dailies and a four-minute dialogue scene or something like that. Are you a Celestrial guy, or are you literally building this actual sequence, the scene itself, as you're watching dailies and finding that stuff?
Well, in a scene like that, I mean, there was one scene in Miami Vice that I cut for Michael Mann that had 9 hours. Nine hours of dailies for a 5-minute dialogue scene. And, you know, you have to be very, I mean, to me, I don't know how other people do it. There's so much, and there's so many different performances and so many different angles. I have my assistants build, you know, line reading assemblies where you have all the readings in a row. I don't like to cut from that, because then you get very, like, robotic, and it gets very, like, this shot for that line. So what I do is I'll have my assistants do that for the recutting or for going into really examining to make sure I got the best out of everything. But when I'm watching, I just make a lot of notes. And whether I handwrite them or type them, everything I feel, and I've heard Walter Mertz say this, because he'll write, I think he refers to it as the banana take for whatever reason, because it made him think of a banana, you know, and it may have nothing to do with the banana. But I'll write every little thing that I like about every take, whether it's a visual moment or it's a performance thing. It'll maybe just be some little, how the characters wipe by the camera that looks gorgeous, or the cars go by, or that, you know, some little piece of special sauce that you put on the scene, you know, like it's like just an intricate, cool image or a cool series of images that really don't have so much to do with the storytelling, but it makes it feel like a little special, you know. But I will make tons and tons and tons of notes and then start, we'll pull those pieces aside and start working with those pieces. Then, time permitting, and I did this on Detroit, and it took forever because I had a lot of dailies, a lot. But it was shot all handheld. No one take is the same as any other take, you know. But with that film, like I said, my assistants would do those select roles of the line-by-line thing. What I would do is go through and take every piece I liked and put it into like one big scene with repeats of action, repeats of lines, just all in scene order. And then, and I would call that all in, you know, so like it's everything I like is in one giant edit. And then I just start going through and, you know, sculpting, I guess. I don't want to say I'm a sculptor, but just like kind of, you know, that one's better than this in conjunction with that. And this works better to tell this story point, you know, and I just sort of instinctually just start whittling it down and getting it to a point where I feel like I have a good scene. And then go back through all the line by line stuff to make sure I didn't miss anything. Because I don't know how you feel, but like I sometimes feel like, you know, there's so much footage, you don't want to like miss a great moment. And then what will happen inevitably is
the director will say, hey, where's that moment?
Yeah. Or like you're going through a dailies later on, recutting, and you find some moment that you missed, you know, and then you put that in if it warrants it. And then you think to yourself, oh my God, if I miss that one moment, how many other moments did I miss? And you start like playing, you know, your head starts playing tricks on you. You think, do I need to go back through all the footage again? Or do I trust myself? And then, you know, I'll sort of start to look through things again to make sure that there's nothing I missed. But, you know, at a certain point, you have to trust yourself.
And that's part of that patience thing of just going, hey, the scene's going to evolve. It's going to get to where it needs to get by the end.
Yeah, but I like this. Michael used to say to me, Michael Cohen would say to me, you say there's three great versions of any scene, and you just want to make sure you show the director one of those three. I still am hoping that this, what I show the director is one of those three versions. I mean, sometimes it's not because, you know, I mean, oftentimes you're like, hey, let's go back and look at my original version thinking it's going to be really great. And you look at it and in the middle, you go, oh my God, that's not really great. Can we stop? This isn't any good. But sometimes you're right and you go back and you go like, yeah, let's put that. Michael Mann is big on doing that. You're like going back. Show me this September 12th version. Show me this, because he'll remember like certain things, you know, and he takes like such fastidious notes that he remembers everything. And
it's a good lesson for an assistant editor right there. Remember to catalog all of the cuts.
Oh my God, is that important? And I don't know about you. I just want to, like, if I have a piece that I don't want to lose, you know, I'll make copies of everything, but, and I'm really organized, but sometimes there'll be like little sections and I know I have them somewhere. And I'll throw them in a bin, an alt bin or a lift bin. And I'm like, you know, occasionally I can't find them because I've done it so fast and I didn't label it properly. As Michael Cohen again would say to me, to go fast or slow down. Because if you try and go too fast, you're going to do like what Paul Greengrass says. You're going to skate over things, you know. Worry about what's in front of you. Worry about the cuts in front of you, the scene that's in front of you. Shut the rest of the world out. And just concentrate on what you're doing, and things will happen a lot faster than if you start stressing out about, oh my God, I have 4 hours of dailies and how am I going to keep up? And because that's when your mind starts fritzing out and you don't do good work, and it'll end up taking twice as long as it would if you just did it right the first time.
Amen. Well, I'm glad that not only did we get an interview with Billy Goldenberg, we also got an interview with Michael Cohen today. A bonus.
Hey, everything I know is from him or because of him. Everything I have is because of him. He just was so wonderful to me and took me under his wing and mentored me, and with a hammer and a chisel molded me into an editor.
Awesome. Billy, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was always fun.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thanks for listening. Also, check out ProVideoCoalition.com for nearly 300 interviews with the world's top editors. Or read the book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated experience. Thanks again to my guest, William Goldenberg, ACE. Also, thanks to Dylan Giovanetto, who edited this episode using Adobe Audition, and to Paul McKenna for mixing and mastering. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. I hope you subscribe to this podcast and give it a review, please. And finally, be sure to share them with a film-making or film-loving friend.